from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
As soon as you put one nation under God in it, we become divisible. Look at this.
The scene on the steps of the U.S. Supreme Court was raucous today as passionate demonstrators competed with calls to keep God in and get God out of the Pledge of Allegiance. Inside the court, one man, California Father Michael Newdow, argued in front of eight justices that two words, under God, should be removed from the pledge. Their presence and their effect are unconstitutional, he said. Newdow, an avowed atheist, said that every time his daughter recites the Pledge of Allegiance in school, it's like a slap in the face of his beliefs. But the words under God have been part of the pledge for 50 years now, and a recent poll finds that almost 90% of Americans would be happy to see it stay that way. But the constitutional challenge is very real. It was a dramatic day at the Supreme Court. This is by no means an open and shut case. Tonight on Point, one nation under God or not, the pledge, the Constitution, and religion in America. We begin tonight in Washington. Dahlia Lithwick reports on the Supreme Court for Slate.com and was inside the chamber today when Michael Newdow and Solicitor General Theodore Olson, the Bush administration lawyer representing the California district where Newdow's daughter goes to school, argued their cases. I asked her to describe the details of the case.
The case is called Elk Grove Unified School District versus Newdow, and it's the challenge to the Pledge of Allegiance that came from a California atheist who didn't believe that his daughter, who was in a public school system, should be made to recite the pledge with the words under God at taxpayer expense, led by, you know, a teacher, a public school teacher on taxpayer salary. He challenged it in California. He actually prevailed at the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. They agreed that the words under God, as added to the pledge, were impermissible entanglements of church and state. And so that's the case that was appealed to the Supreme Court today.
And Michael Newdow is an emergency room doctor who also has a law degree and sort of amazingly decided to represent himself before the Supreme Court.
That's correct. And I would say, as a longtime observer of the court, that one of the first rules we in the press corps have is that when people are so zealous that they represent themselves all the way up to the Supreme Court, they're generally lunatics. And they generally do very poorly before the Supreme Court because the sorts of things that let you be the kind of person who represents yourself all the way to the Supreme Court, that sort of passion, that deep, crazy investment in the case, are the sorts of things that make Supreme Court justices' eyes roll. But with that said, Newdow did an absolutely superb job. I've seen veteran oral advocates in the Supreme Court who are not even close to the caliber of argument that I saw today.
So good that he was getting open applause in the courtroom, which brought a remonstration from the Chief Justice, Rehnquist.
That's true. Unheard of, certainly in my career, and there were people sitting around me who've been on this beat for many, many decades. No one's ever heard of a spontaneous outburst. Essentially, what happened was that Chief Justice Rehnquist and Newdow were going back and forth about how truly divisive and controversial the words under God, as inserted in the pledge in 1954, really are. Rehnquist tried to make the point that when they were inserted into the pledge, it was by a unanimous vote, therefore it's obviously not that divisive. Newdow kind of came back with a very quick rejoinder. He said, well, that's because no atheist can get elected to Congress.
And on came the applause. Was the Chief Justice banging his gavel and bulging his eyes, or was it more low-key than that?
He was furious. He said, I will clear the courtroom if I hear any more applause. And no one has ever, you know, heard words like that out of his mouth. I think one of the really interesting things in this case is that there's this sort of legal theme that says those words under God are not about God. You know, the terminology in the legal system is ceremonial deism. It means that we say the words, but they've been drained of all meaning, and that the God part isn't important. This isn't a prayer. This isn't about religion. And it's very interesting because if that were the case, protesters out front wouldn't have been ready to kill each other. If that were the case, people wouldn't be bursting into applause. So I think one of the sort of sleights of hand in this case is that you can sort of go on and on about how those words don't actually have meaning, but it's fairly clear just from the level of tempers after the Ninth Circuit opinion and again today that those words have a terrific amount of meaning, and that's really what's on the table.
But what you've just described is, in effect, the argument of Solicitor General Theodore Olson, the Bush administration lawyer arguing for the school district. He said, the Pledge of Allegiance. He wrote is like the national anthem or memorizing the Gettysburg Address. He said today it's a ceremonial patriotic exercise, not an exercise of religion.
That's right. I mean, he talked a lot about the history of the founding of the Republic, and he felt very strongly that the founders of the Republic really truly believed that it was God who gave them the strength to revolt and to create a new nation. And so that it's sort of a historical fact, as far as he was concerned, that this was a nation under God and that it has nothing to do with prayer. Newdow's response to that was interesting. He said, it doesn't have to be prayer to be impermissible entangling church and state. He talked about the Ten Commandments cases as an example. You know, it doesn't need to be about prayer per se. It simply needs to be sending the message, and again, we're talking about impressionable school children, that there is a God. And, Newdow described hearing the pledge as repeated slaps to his face.
Now, there was the chance, perhaps the chance remains, that all this would be moot. Newdow is the father of the girl who's in the Elk Grove School District, but he hasn't married the mother. He doesn't have custody during the school week of her. And there was a challenge here. I think it was the initial challenge of the government saying he doesn't even have standing to represent her here.
That's correct. And the first, I would say, 20 minutes of today's hour-long oral argument really revolved around the standing question. In some sense, it would be great for the court if they could make it go away on the standing issue, because then they would never need to go to the thorny question of, you know, church-state entanglement and the pledge. The issue of standing is problematic. The court seemed quite sensitive, though, to the notion that Newdow has to have some right to assert his own desire to control his daughter's religious education. And Justice Kennedy kept describing it as, you know, having a level playing field and not sort of tipping the balance so that a father who didn't have custody was effectively completely wiped out of the picture. So it was not clear from the eight justices who heard the case today, recalling that Justice Scalia had to recuse himself, that there were going to be a majority of justices who were going to find that he did not have standing.
Eight justices and not nine, Antonin Scalia having recused himself because he was publicly critical of the Ninth Circuit decision. Is that why?
Well, you know, one never knows why justices recuse themselves. They don't usually do what Scalia did last week and post lengthy memoranda. But certainly Newdow, among his many other talents, had the absolutely unprecedented brashness of asking Scalia to recuse himself based on Scalia's comments, and Scalia did it.
If there should be a 4-4 vote, what happens?
Well, then the Ninth Circuit opinion stands, and at least in the states in the Ninth Circuit, that policy of having the pledge with the words under God is unconstitutional.
In other words, a tie vote means no national precedent, but the Ninth Circuit ruling stands for this particular case.
That's correct.
And the actual issue here is whether or not the school district can require teachers to lead students in reciting the pledge.
That's right. The original Ninth Circuit opinion was broader. The original Ninth Circuit opinion said those words under God as added to the pledge in 1954 were unconstitutional per se. They narrowed that slightly. So now the question is about the school district policy, although in effect, it's sort of the same issues.
What's the guessing among court watchers here about how this might go?
Well, I don't think anyone thought Newdow really was going to prevail. People thought it was going to be 4-4. But it appeared to me that he had some friends today, that justices like Kennedy were very, very interested in this notion of kids being forced to stand there and do something that appeared to be about God. This is a very, very tough case. It's sort of the fallout from decades of horrible, horrible religion cases in the Supreme Court and all these various tests, and nobody knows exactly what the law is anymore. So the court has an opportunity to clear up some of its messes. We can only hope that they'll marshal a majority to do that.
When is a decision likely to come down?
Sometime before June.
Dahlia, thanks very much for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
Dahlia Lithwick reports on the Supreme Court for Slate.com. She spoke with me earlier from Washington.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Under God, just two words in the Pledge of Allegiance recited there by President Bush and children from East Literature Middle School in Nashville, Tennessee. Two words that have inflamed passions and put what could be a historic case in front of the Supreme Court today. After what some called a virtuoso performance, California father and atheist Michael Newdow had this to say to reporters as he left the court this afternoon.
I am a parent. I have an absolute right to know that when my child goes to the public schools, she's not going to be indoctrinated with any religious dogma. I'm not asking for them to say that there's no God. I want government to stay out of the religion business.
Newdow's wife, Sandra Banning, a born-again Christian who filed, actually not his wife, but the mother of his daughter, Sandra Banning, a born-again Christian, who filed an amicus brief in favor of keeping Under God in the Pledge, reacted differently.
As a mother, as a Christian and American, as I've said, I'm hoping that the court will resolve this issue. I hope and pray that they will support our history, the traditions of our nation, and the values that we hold dear.
So what do you think? Should Under God stay in the Pledge of Allegiance? If Americans didn't need God in the pledge when it was written in 1892, do they need it there today? Does Under God undermine the Constitution or not? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Jim Henderson, senior attorney for the American Center for Law and Justice, a Christian legal agency that filed an amicus brief in support of the pledge. He was at the Supreme Court today hearing the arguments. Good evening and welcome, Jim Henderson.
Good evening, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. And with us from Los Angeles is Erwin Chemerinsky, professor of public interest law, legal ethics, and political science at the University of Southern California. He is a close advisor to Michael Newdow and helped Newdow prepare his case. Good evening and welcome, Erwin Chemerinsky.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
It's wonderful to have you. You must be, I don't know what the right word is, a kind of proud papa tonight. My understanding is that you're part of the group who helped prep Michael Newdow to go before the Supreme Court, and it sounds as though, at least in this first day, he's pulled it off rather well.
I'm not at all surprised. I got to work with Mike a great deal on his briefs and helping get ready for the oral argument, and he was superbly prepared. He's really lived this case for years, and so I was very pleased to hear what a great job he did.
But he's an emergency room doctor. Has he ever practiced law?
Well, he's also a graduate of the University of Michigan Law School, and he has handled a number of cases that he's brought challenging various religious aspects of government practices.
Erwin Chemerinsky, lay out for us then, as the Supreme Court heard it today and will hear it, exactly what Michael Newdow's saying.
His argument is simple. For over 40 years, the Supreme Court has said that government-sponsored religious activity in public school classrooms isn't allowed. The words "under God" are inherently religious. This isn't like the words "in God we trust" on money, because we don't have to say those words to spend money. This isn't like the phrase "God save this honorable court," because nobody has to recite that phrase to argue before the court. His argument is that children feel pressure every day to affirm that we're a nation under God, and for the government to put that pressure on children violates the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment.
Jim Henderson, what is your view? Are the words "under God" in the Pledge of Allegiance representing religion?
Well, unfortunately, we may not be able to communicate well on this issue unless we can come to a common understanding, and this is always the problem. As we begin to look at the question of whether "under God" is problematic under the Constitution, we think we have to start out by understanding the meaning of the Establishment Clause. When that is the question before us, the meaning of the Establishment Clause, then we can perhaps have a dialogue, maybe disagree on its meaning, but at least have some sense of where we stand. In our understanding of the Establishment Clause, there is nothing about the inclusion of the words "under God" in the pledge which compels one to support a state religion, deprives one of a license to practice a profession, prevents one from serving on a jury or voting, and thus has none of the habiliments of an established church in the United States. Instead, it is simply the statement of a basic political philosophy of our country, which is, frankly, not at all religious.
And if it offends, then, the sensibilities of an American citizen who's an atheist, does that matter in your view or not under the Constitution?
Well, the Supreme Court said it mattered 60 years ago. In the West Virginia Barnett case, where the court allowed us how the state of West Virginia could not compel persons who were conscientiously opposed to pledging allegiance to the flag to do so on pain of being expelled from the schools, thereby, and from that day forward, always requiring every school district, including Elk Grove, to allow persons who conscientiously object to pledging from doing so.
And yet there's the issue, I guess, that's here of coercion. We've got a lot to talk about tonight. We're looking at one nation under God or not in the Pledge of Allegiance, the question before the Supreme Court today. You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about one nation under God or not in the Pledge of Allegiance, the question before the Supreme Court today. Joining us tonight from Washington, Jim Henderson, a senior attorney at the American Center for Law and Justice, a Christian legal agency. They have filed an amicus brief to the court in support of under God in the Pledge. Joining us from Los Angeles tonight, Erwin Chemerinsky, professor of public interest law, legal ethics, and political science at the University of Southern California, and advisor to Michael Newdow, who helped him prepare to make his case today. You can join the conversation tonight. Does God belong in the Pledge of Allegiance? If Americans didn't need God in the Pledge in 1892, do they need God there today? And do you buy that under God is just a ceremonial phrase here? Isn't God God, especially when you're pledging allegiance? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Erwin Chemerinsky, Jim Henderson says, look, yes, it says God there, but that is not in conflict with the Establishment Clause. This is not an attempt by the government to establish religion, to be entangled in religion, to impose religion in anyone's life.
Mr. Henderson's view of the Establishment Clause is very different than what the United States Supreme Court has said for the last 50 years. The Supreme Court has said there can't be government-sponsored religious activity in public school classrooms. There can't be voluntary prayer. There can't even be a clergy member delivering a prayer at public schools. There can't even be a moment of silent prayer, the Supreme Court says. There can't even be students delivering prayers at high school football games, because all of these coerce children into participating in religion. The reality is the words under God are inherently religious. What if the pledge said one nation under Jesus? Is there any denial that that would be unconstitutional? Well, the words one nation under God are just as much an establishment religion for those who don't believe in God or those who don't believe in a theistic God.
Jim Henderson?
A couple of points. Number one, the court was quite troubled by the assertion. I guess I might have attended a different argument than your reporter from Slate, but the court seemed to be quite troubled by the argument that the phrase under God included in the press the pledge constituted any kind of a prayer. And they repeatedly pressed Mr. Newdow, who did do quite well in argument. I was impressed with his ability to withstand what seemed at times to be withering attacks from almost every quarter. Mm-hmm. But the court could not, as near as I could see, find that saying under God in a generalized pledge of allegiance constituted the kind of prayer that was at issue in any of the cases to which Professor Chemerinsky adverts, the football prayer cases, the classroom prayer cases, the graduation prayer cases, all constituted prayer cases, and this phrase in a pledge is not that. I think it's true that the Supreme Court, using a variety of tests, has come to the same conclusion about prayer activities in classrooms when they're directed by state authorities. But I'm not sure that it's clear that those decisions, which are about prayer, apply to the pledge. And, of course, that's ultimately what this case will decide.
Erwin Chemerinsky, how do you think it's going to ultimately be decided? We see a new Associated Press poll of Americans finds 87%, almost 90% say that the words under God should remain in the Pledge of Allegiance. Do you think that whatever the legal arguments, will the court have the nerve to kick out what has become, you know, sort of mother's milk familiar to generations of Americans now?
I think this is a court that does have the nerve. I think this court sees its role as interpreting the Constitution, even when it's going against public sentiment. This is, after all, the court that decided who was going to be the next president of the United States in Bush versus Gore. My prediction is that this is going to be a 6-2 or 5-3 decision to affirm the Ninth Circuit, to say that the words under God, even though not a prayer, are inherently religious, and students should not feel pressured to say them in public schools.
But you're granting Jim Henderson's point that this would be an extension of their former position, that they have objected to prayer in many circumstances. But you're saying even if they find this is not, doesn't amount to prayer, that they'll sort of pull their robes over this and say this is also part of a, I'm not sure of the right word here, but this is religion.
the question isn't, is this a prayer? The question is this government-sponsored religious activity in public school classrooms? The question is, do students feel coerced to affirm a belief in God because of what the school district is doing? And I think the court will say the words under God are all about religion. And the reality is students do feel pressure to say the words in school.
Jim Henderson, given the careful church-state delineation in the U.S. Constitution, given the fact that the pledge was originally written without this phrase, and we know the history of why it was included, it was a Cold War move by Congress, it's very familiar now, and Americans are even fond of it. But in strictly constitutional terms, why put this in the face of American children every morning in a civic setting, not a church setting?
Well, I think Mr. Cassidy spoke to it pretty well this morning in the argument. This is not some bizarre artifact where we grab as young as kindergarten, first and second grade children and drub them with under God, under God. They are, under California standards of learning, in the first grade being taught about the nature of our government and its origins. And the fact is that, as Mr. Cassidy said in his closing points on rebuttal, the phrase under God may have been seen by some as a thumb in the eye of godless atheistic communism, but it was more than that, and Congress said that it was more than that. It was an expression of our basic political philosophy, and so why expose children to an understanding of our basic political philosophy as a country, as is embodied in our Declaration of Independence? Well, because we want them to learn the things that are important about our political system, including the nature of its origins.
But it wasn't there at the beginning, in 1892, and it wasn't there for 60 years. What does that say to you?
Well, I mean, the presence or absence at any particular time can't prove rightness or wrongness. Otherwise, of course, there'd be no freedom for African Americans or vote for women and a variety of other practices that can't be justified historically. Why should it be in there? Well, the fact is it need not particularly be in there. But the people of the United States in their national legislature chose to put it in there. And the question is, why must it come out? Because of the complaint of a man who doesn't have a discrete legal relationship to the offense that he claims occurs here.
Erwin Chemerinsky, I guess that point in itself is being debated before the court. But what about Jim Henderson's fundamental position here, at least on this side, that this is core to U.S. American political philosophy? You've got it in God We Trust. You've got in the Declaration of Independence a reference to the Creator. You've got George Washington, as William Sapphire was pointing out today in the Times, you know, in his very first oath-taking for office, saying, "So help me God." God is no stranger to American civic environments.
And students, certainly in a history class, can look at the framers' beliefs. They can see how the framers did believe in God. They can study the Declaration of Independence. All of that, though, is very different than telling students at the beginning of the school day that they're supposed to say, "We are a nation under God." This is pressuring students to affirm a religious belief. And as I said earlier, it's very different than "In God We Trust" on money, because we don't feel pressure to say those words when we spend coins. You don't have to say, "God save this honorable court," to argue in the Supreme Court. But children do feel pressure to say, "We're a nation under God." And I think it's interesting that even Mr. Sapphire, in the piece you referred to, and certainly we think of him as more conservative than liberal, said that he thinks that it's an easy case. The words "under God" and the Pledge of Allegiance are unconstitutional.
Of course, he said it should come out, but what he actually suggests is that schools simply be instructed to instruct children that if they don't favor that phrase, that they just stay silent during those two words of the pledge. Would that satisfy Michael Newdow?
Of course not, and it won't satisfy the Supreme Court. In the school prayer cases, the schools argued, well, students who don't want to say it can remain silent, but they still feel pressure, and the Supreme Court said school prayer is unconstitutional. In the clergy-delivered prayer at public school graduation, the school said, well, if students don't want to listen, they can step off the stage, they don't have to pay attention, and the Supreme Court said, but there's something inherently coercive. When my 5-year-old daughter started at a Los Angeles public school in September, just this last year, she came home and showed her mom and me how she learned to recite the Pledge of Allegiance.
Mm-hmm.
And she put her hand on her heart and recited it. And my wife, who's also a law professor, said to me, well, I thought the kids didn't have to say that anymore in public schools because of the Ninth Circuit opinion. My daughter overheard this and said, oh, yes, you do, or you get sent to the principal's office. Now, that's not what her teacher said, but she internalized in her first week of kindergarten that you're supposed to do this, and if not, you get in trouble, and when you get in trouble, you go to the principal's office. That's what kids feel all over the country. That's why the Ninth Circuit came to the conclusion it did.
Sounds like coercion to your daughter. Listeners, you can join us tonight. We're talking about one nation under God or not in the Pledge of Allegiance. Almost 90% of Americans polled say leave it alone. Is that a constitutional position? Is it just support for what's familiar? A vote for melding church and state. Can you imagine telling little Johnny and Sue that God isn't in the pledge anymore? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Steve is calling from Tingsboro, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm an atheist and a military veteran, and I object to the words under God and the Pledge of Allegiance. I have a young son who's going to be starting school in 4 or 5 years, and I don't want him exposed to that.
And exactly why, Steve?
I think it's coercive. I mean, it brings to my mind the scene from a movie called Nowhere in Africa where a young Jewish girl is going to an English boarding school, and every day, all the Jewish kids are sent to the side of the room so that they can say the Lord's Prayer.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want something like that to happen to my son.
Steve, stick with us. Jim Henderson, here's an American citizen saying, I feel it's coercive. I feel it's imposing religion on me. It will one day impose it on my son in school if it's not changed. What do you say to him?
Well, I guess I'd say that his son has the absolute right not to say the prayer. And I'm not sure what to do in a government and in a society constituting very different people to make him a happier man about the circumstance. If Mr. Newdow succeeds and the words under God are stricken from the pledge, where will he and Professor Chemerinsky go in response to the 87% of the people who will insist more vociferously than ever in pronouncing every day, as the pledge is said, led by the teacher, omitting the words under God, and the students nonetheless insist not only on saying under God, but on saying it loud and proud. Will they then begin the crackdown that one federal judge in the graduation prayer context said that he would have students held in contempt if they prayed at graduation? How far will they go in silencing the view they don't like? Because it's not about his son being compelled to say these things. His son is absolutely protected from being compelled to say these things. It's about whether he hears them. That's his objection. He doesn't like to hear these things. And the only way to prevent that is to silence somebody else.
Well, but are you then, are you threatening mob action here, or are you talking about this in constitutional terms? You're saying, well, if the Supreme Court makes an honest decision that this is against the letter and spirit of the Constitution, that let everybody just defy the court? Is that your solution?
Well, I presume that the only thing the court could do here is say that Elk Grove Unified School District cannot require the recitation of the pledge with the words under God. I can't imagine that either Professor Chemerinsky or his fine young protege, Mr. Newdow, believe that they have the right to compel silence by students who believe that the words under God belong in the pledge. Surely they don't intend to suppress the constitutional freedoms of other students and other citizens so that they can enjoy their own, do they?
Steve, Jim Henderson is saying that your son shouldn't feel coerced here because your son will not have to say the pledge. That's protected.
Has he never been exposed to peer pressure in grammar school?
What about that, Jim Henderson? The coercive aspect seems kind of clear to anybody who's been to grammar school.
I completely understand and sympathize with Steve's concern about the coercive aspects of the public school system. A point was made in argument today that, in fact, an important component of instruction in the schools is respect for diversity and respect for differences. And so if there is a problem with the kind of coercion and peer pressure that Steve is referring to, I won't deny that these things occur, but I will say that's a defect in the public school system, not in the pledge.
Steve, thanks very much for your call. Erwin Chemerinsky, that coercion is a defect in the way the schools exercise the recitation of the pledge.
It's inherent to the nature of elementary schools and even secondary schools. What I found so interesting listening to Mr. Henderson is the same arguments could have been made against Supreme Court decisions finding prayer in schools unconstitutional. Mr. Henderson said, well, the court can declare prayers unconstitutional, but they can't stop students who want to say prayers from saying prayers. And in the school prayer case, he said, you know, the real problem isn't the government leading prayers. It's that there's peer pressure the schools aren't taking care of. The Supreme Court gave no weight to those kind of arguments in the school prayer cases. They're not going to do so here. The reality is any student who wants to silently say a prayer can do so. Any group of students who want to go out on the playground and pray, they can do so. And if students want to say to themselves, under God, or students want to go to the playground and recite, under God, they can certainly do that. But the reality is it shouldn't be the school district requiring it. It shouldn't be the teachers leading the students and saying, under God. That's where the inherent coercion is, and that's why it's likely to be found unconstitutional.
We're at 1-800-423-8255. Wasim is calling from Boston. Hi, Wasim. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing?
Well, thanks.
I'm calling as a Christian who was brought up in the United Arab Emirates, which is a predominantly Muslim country.
Mm-hmm.
And every year in the Arabic literature class, we had to recite and memorize a verse from the Quran. And as a Christian, I believe I felt extremely offended trying to learn something about another religion, which wasn't part of my religion. And their excuse was that we're learning the verse for its literal content and not for its religious content. And I totally believe that there should be a separation between church and state and that under God should be removed. And not only that, let's say under God, instead of having capital G, we had it as small g. That will definitely offend Christians. And I totally believe that God should be removed from the Pledge of Allegiance.
Given your experience as a Christian growing up in an Islamic culture, Wasim, thanks for your call. Jim Henderson, what do you say to that perspective?
Well, I appreciate the perspective, but I don't think that the outcome is any different given his experience. Because ultimately we have to repair to the document that everybody is pointing to here, the Constitution and the particular clause, the Establishment Clause. And under the Establishment Clause, this simply is not a violation. I am heartened in a way to have heard Professor Chemerinsky's response to my question, though. And I want to make sure that everybody's clear what's on the agenda, because Mr. Newdow is not satisfied to silence teachers leading the pledge. He has declared, professor has here tonight, that students will be prevented from voluntarily saying under God as part of a classroom exercise, even if the teacher doesn't lead them in it. It will begin to be a point of discipline, I'm sure, because Mr. Newnow won't be happy with merely silencing teachers. He will only be happy when only his view of what the pledge should say is the one which predominates in the public school.
We will come right back and look at that. Jim Henderson, Erwin Chemerinsky, please stand by. We're talking tonight about one nation under God or not in the Pledge of Allegiance. The question before the Supreme Court today, does God belong in the Pledge of Allegiance? If Americans didn't need God in the pledge in 1892, do they need God there today? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about one nation under God or not in the Pledge of Allegiance, the question before the Supreme Court today. My guest tonight, Jim Henderson, senior attorney at the American Center for Law and Justice, a Christian legal agency. They have filed an amicus brief to the court in support of under God in the pledge. Joining us from Los Angeles, Erwin Chemerinsky, professor of political interest law, legal ethics, and political science at the University of Southern California, and an advisor to Michael Newdow, who made his case before the court today against under God in the pledge. You can join our conversation tonight. Does God belong in the Pledge of Allegiance? Almost 90% of Americans polled say, leave it alone, leave it in. What do you say? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Is it coercion? Is it tradition? Is it within the expectation of the Constitution? Is it somewhere without? Have we just gotten used to this, whether it's constitutional or not? 1-800-423-TALK. Tim is calling from Waukesha, Wisconsin. Hi, Tim. You're on the air. Hello, Tim. Are you there, my friend? Oh, dear. Well, Tim, I hope you're well. Rebecca is calling from Boston. Hi, Rebecca. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I actually believe that the words "under God" should be removed from the pledge. And speaking from personal experience, my mother is a middle school teacher in a town in Virginia where there's a strange mix of the town both being rural and there's a large university there as well. So there's a constant influx of foreign students in her school, what mm-hmm. with professors coming and going and graduate students and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And it's obviously very important for them, especially at that age, to be accepted by their peers and try to fit in. But at the same time, they don't feel comfortable, you know, reciting the words "under God" on a daily basis. So my mom, you know, repeatedly told them that if they didn't want to say the pledge, they didn't have to, that they could sit down, they didn't even have to stand. But they continued to do it, even though, you know, she knew that they felt uncomfortable about
it. Rebecca, are you saying these were actually not American students, but the children of visiting professors from other countries, or?
In both, I would say in both cases. She had students who were children of visiting professors, and then also students who just happened to be of other nationalities.
Okay.
And so it finally came to the point where one day, in an attempt to support them, she actually sat down herself and sat out during the pledge. And,
to demonstrate that that was all right, that was a real option.
Exactly. And consequently, she herself was brought to the principal's office and reprimanded and actually threatened with her job. So it's not just the children that are being sort of coerced and living in this unpleasant environment as a consequence, but the teachers as well are being coerced into doing something that maybe they don't believe in and that they don't believe that their students should have to be subjected to.
It's an interesting story. Thanks very much for sharing it, Rebecca. Erwin Chemerinsky, what do you make of that?
I think that what goes on there happens in schools all over the country every day. The reality is when you're talking about young children, they do want to be accepted, whether it's foreign students, as Rebecca's example, or just Americans who want to be accepted by their peers. There is pressure to say the words "under God." And that's why I think that the court's going to say this is much like the school prayer cases, where even if it was voluntary prayer, the court says it violates the Establishment Clause.
And Jim Henderson, here's a teacher who tried to demonstrate that it was optional and was threatened with, we're told by Rebecca, with being fired. How do you interpret that?
Well, I interpret it as the state of Virginia doing precisely what other states have done in other circumstances. It hasn't been that long ago that the California teacher was disciplined for seeking to avoid teaching about evolution entirely against the specific standards imposed by California science instructional requirements. In Virginia, where I happen to be speaking to you
mm-hmm.
from tonight,
mm-hmm.
State law requires that a sign be posted, "One Nation Under God," and the use of the pledge is a time-honored tradition and an appropriate exercise. There is an absolute right to opt out for conscientious reasons, and as long as there's not a conscientious reason to opt out, there's no reason not to require students to participate in the activities of the classroom.
But even if the teacher simply wanted to demonstrate that that option was real in the spirit of the Constitution, mightn't that be a conscientious reason in itself?
Well, it might well be, but I think the teacher is obliged to take the job that's offered to them and to perform the duties that are expected of them. And if a teacher decides to make it their personal crusade to end the practices provided for by school policies by undermining them in the classroom and encouraging dissent from them in the classroom,
mm-hmm.
that's you know, it seems to me that's fair game for them to do, but it's also fair game for them to be willing to take whatever consequences flow from it.
Interesting. It sounded to me as though Rebecca's mom was trying to demonstrate that that option was real. But there's a very strong tradition here. Chuck is calling from Kinston, North Carolina. Hi, Chuck. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing?
Real well, thanks.
Well, I think this runs deeper than just a constitutional issue. Where I'm coming from on this, it seems as though the few dictate to the many what should be and shouldn't be. If I had a child that was a vegetarian and he felt uncomfortable eating in the cafeteria that served chicken and meat, why should we continue to do that?
Understood. But, Chuck, does it give you any pause that this phrase was not originally in the pledge? And, of course, the Constitution itself is supposed to both protect the practice of religion but also draw a line between church and state.
I think that what you look at when I say the pledge and say one nation under God, mm-hmm. I think of all the forefathers that came to this country for religious freedom, whether it was Christianity, whether it was later on for the Jewish faith, whether now you've got Muslims, whether you have Buddhists. A lot of people come to this country for religious freedoms. And I think that now this is one nation that is founded and has a deep faith in terms of there being a God.
And it's just a fact of history, and so be it, you're saying.
That's exactly right.
Chuck, thanks very much for your call. Erwin Chemerinsky, what about it? I mean, the tradition is so deep. It's inarguable, and it goes all the way back. As we said, it's right there in the Declaration of Independence, the reference to the Creator, even from a man like Thomas Jefferson, who was not terribly himself religious. Chuck says, don't take this away from us. On the other hand, Under God was not originally in the Pledge of Allegiance. I don't know how acquainted you are with the history, but are Americans' attitudes about the church and state divide changing here? Have they changed over the last century? Are Americans more welcoming of God into civic discourse now? What's the evolution?
Let me start with how this was added. As you've pointed out throughout our conversation, the words under God were not originally in the Pledge of Allegiance when it was adopted in 1892. It was put in there in 1954. Members of Congress said that now that we're fighting godless communism, we should affirm and have our children affirm a belief in God. I want to respond to the caller's example. He said, well, why should the few dictate to the many? The whole point of the Bill of Rights is to protect the minority from the majority. He says, should a child who's a vegetarian have to watch others eating meat? There's a real difference there. That's not about religion. Certainly there's many ways in which children may feel uncomfortable. But the whole point of the Establishment Clause is that our government should be secular, so that everyone feels comfortable there. If people want to believe, if they want to express their belief in God, they certainly can do so. But it shouldn't be for the government and teachers to lead students in reciting We're Under God. That's inherently religious, and that doesn't belong in the public schools.
Jim Henderson, Erwin Chemerinsky is guessing that the court is going to rule in favor of Under God coming out. He's saying by a 6-2 or 5-3 vote. How do you read the court?
I guess I fundamentally disagree, having watched the argument today.
Mm-hmm.
I do say that Mr. Newdow did a very fine argument. There were other very fine arguments that day as well. But at the end of the day, the basic rules that govern litigation in the courts, the constitutional requirements that govern litigation in the courts, no more give to me, a person who watches a car accident on the evening news, the right to complain about injuries suffered by others in that car accident than they give to Mr. Newdow, who has no custodial control over his daughter's schooling, the right to complain in the courts here. I don't think we're going to get a pledge decision. I think we're going to get a decision that says if there's somebody who's got a legitimate beef, let them come forward.
Very quickly, would you welcome the court not going to a pledge decision, or would you rather see them come down clearly one way or another?
Well, I think the absolutely correct thing to have happened here is what the district court did. This case should be dismissed as it's nearly frivolous nature demands of it, and as every other one of Mr. Newdow's frivolous complaints regarding chaplaincies and inaugural prayer and the like have fallen victim.
Well, it may happen that way, but it may not, and we may see a significant change here. I want to thank both of you for being with us tonight. Jim Henderson at the American Center for Law and Justice, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Erwin Chemerinsky in Los Angeles at the University of Southern California, an advisor to Michael Newdow, thank you very much for being with
My
us tonight.
My pleasure.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, one woman's case for replacing the Pledge of Allegiance with the preamble to the U.S. Constitution. This is On Point. As the Supreme Court takes up the case of whether school teachers should be allowed to lead students in the Pledge of Allegiance to a nation under God, constitutional scholar Linda Monk believes that the country's children should be reciting a different patriotic affirmation, the preamble to the Constitution. In this radio diary, Linda Monk reflects on the origins of America's Pledge of Allegiance and why she believes the Constitution's preamble is a better and more patriotic alternative.
The history about the pledge is that it was written in 1892 to commemorate the 400th anniversary of Columbus's discovery of America by a socialist minister in a kids' magazine. And I think what it goes to show is the power of when something is done every day in schools, how it does become part of our national civic life. We've kind of assumed, well, the pledge is just part of our patriotic background, but no one's ever really thought, is it the best expression of what we want to affirm together as citizens? And my belief is that it's not. It's actually a very poor reflection of what we want to accomplish as citizens, and the preamble's a much better choice. The preamble to the Constitution really sets forth what the purposes of our government are. It starts off with those three most powerful words in the whole Constitution, we the people. It says that the people are the ones who are sovereign. And that really, when you think about it, is the most important part of American government that our founders set forth in 1787 in our highest form of law, the U.S. Constitution. My belief is that the words of the preamble are, in truth, our national credo. I believe that we believe that government is and should be founded on the people. And as a constitutional scholar, what's amazed me is how many times people who were excluded from the legal definition of we the people nonetheless believed in that concept of government of the people. You know, Frederick Douglass says in the 1850s, it's we the people, not we the white people. Susan Anthony says in the late 1800s, it's we the whole people, not we the half people, meaning the males. There is something about those words that captivates people that have been excluded from the process to affirm that we are included. We believe we are part of this we the people. And that's been reflected through constitutional amendments, the 13th Amendment to end slavery, the 15th Amendment to give black men the vote, the 19th Amendment to give women the vote. This ongoing process, this dynamic process of we the people, I don't want that ever to end. And the way it won't end is if we the people continue to affirm it. That by that repetition over and over again in our civic ceremonies, in our schools, we'll remember our high calling as citizens and keep the American dream alive. We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America.
Linda Monk is a constitutional scholar and the author of The Words We Live By, Your Annotated Guide to the Constitution. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.